Welcome to Recalculating Small Business.
Americans spend billions of dollars on their pets. Here to talk about how they love their pets and he helps them is Chris Middleton, the president of Pets Best. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Chris, tell us a little bit about yourself, your company, and how you fit into the pet world.
So Pets Best was the only insurance company actually founded by a doctor of veterinary medicine, and that's Jack Stevens, who in fact founded pet insurance in the U.S. about 30 years ago. And we have been selling pet insurance policies since 2005. And there's about 12 or 13 insurance players in the U.S., of which we're one of the more significant participants in the market. And the U.S. pet insurance industry is, relative to some other countries, still relatively modest in terms of the number of pets insured, but it has been growing extremely rapidly over the last several years as, in general, the human-animal bond continues to evolve. Personally, I'm the owner of three dogs, all three of which are sitting in the office with me, and one of which I've spent the morning in the emergency vet with. And I've been at Pets Best a little over 7 years after a number of years in the high-tech industry and decided to go into an industry that I had some real passion about, and that's animals and pets. And it's been a real enjoyable ride, and it's fun to participate. It's fun to participate in an industry that's really helping folks and that I feel very passionate about.
Well, Chris, I'm going to ask one question and turn it over to Dan, but I'm curious, can you actually buy insurance the same as you can buy it for a human for various ailments? And dogs, cats, and parakeets? Can you give us a little bit of an outline of what you do and how people do it, use you?
Sure. So in many respects, pet health insurance is very much like a comprehensive insurance plan for people, although there are a variety of different kind of specialty plans, but the majority of the industry and the majority of our sales are for full breadth of coverage for accident and illnesses. And aside from pre-existing conditions not being covered, which is simply a function of, otherwise people would wait to buy insurance until after they had a problem. Our policies cover just virtually every issue that a pet could experience from a medical standpoint. So typically, not all of the industry, but much of the industry will have annual deductibles or per incident deductibles, and then a copay, and then an annual limit that ranges from $5,000 a year up to absolutely no limit. So I've got my dogs on no limit plans, and that just means that I, no matter what happens to them, I've got financial coverage. And then, as I said, we've also got some specialty plans, accident-only plans, and you can buy complimentary coverage to help with routine care as well. So very, very comprehensive accident and illness plans.
Dan, it's up to you now.
Thank you. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan.
I'm curious, having had a number of dogs in my life, I'm an older gentleman, and we don't have any pets at the moment. When you talk about the size of the market, how many pets would you say are insured right now under pet insurance in the United States?
Oh, about 1.4, 1.5 million.
And out of the universe of how many pets?
Oh, about not quite 180 million, depending upon which.
Wow.
Which number you look at, yeah. And this contrasts with some of the European countries that have 20, 25 plus percent of their pets insured.
but significantly smaller populations?
Correct. Yeah, significantly smaller in European countries, but a higher percentage of pets are insured, although the U.S. market has been growing dramatically over the last several years.
Yeah, so the industry has a penetration rate a little over 1% into the pet population.
A touch shy of 1%, yeah.
Okay. Are there any particular pets that you don't insure?
Oh, yeah, sorry, I missed the previous question. So with the exception of one player in the industry that covers what we in the industry call exotics, rabbits, parakeets, gerbils, and things like that, all the other carriers and ourselves provide coverage for cats and dogs. So the primary industry is centered on cats and dogs, with dogs being the predominant pets.
The dogs are the predominant pet. You know,
yeah.
I listened to the compassion you had about in your off the air talk about the pets that you just spent 3 hours in the emergency care with, and it's admirable of your compassion. And I know I had similar issues with our last dog as she got beyond to the point that she could no longer stand, and we were dealing with other issues. But I understand your compassion. What I don't understand is, at times it makes me angry, the commercials that we see on television about the abused pets, mostly dogs, and looking for, you know, $18 a month to help take care of these terribly unfortunate pets. Are we out of control in terms of population of pets? I mean, we've got over 100 million pets in the United States with a 340 million population. That's almost like one out of every three household has some form of a pet, a cat or a dog.
You know, that's a really good question. And there are certainly a large number of pets that are brought into this world with no good plan in place for them. However, the growth of shelters and no-kill shelters, and the fact that increasingly the most popular place for people to adopt their pet from is the shelter channel, I think we've made good inroads into this area, particularly with the large number of spay and neuter programs that are going on right now. Not to say in any way that we don't have an issue, and you know, the feral cat issues are particularly problematic, but I think there's been a great deal of progress made in this area.
So what has been happening to the physical population of cats and dogs, say, over the last 10 years?
You know, it's interesting. The recession actually caused pet ownership to decline during the recession, and it's been slowly building since that time. In terms of how the actual pet population has been reacting, that I don't have firm data off the top of my head. I just know that pet ownership took a hit, because pets, if you take care of them adequately, are pretty pricey propositions, and
right.
It's been making some level of rebound since the recession
as
ended.
The economy's rebounded, perhaps the discretionary money to take care of a pet. It's amazing to me the many years ago I was an industrial engineer, and one of my clients was the Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio, and they have one of the best veterinary schools in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to do a lot of work, not with the pets, but with all the mechanical systems that were used to clean the air and do all kinds of things for the pets that they were there. Amazing place, and amazing doctors, and the things that they will do to take care of pets. And I don't mean to be harsh. I just want to ask a question. Are we obsessed with our pets in the country or around the world, or do we have a blasé attitude when we no longer want them? We just toss them away? What do you think?
Well, I undoubtedly there are a small there is a small population of folks who have an attitude that pets are disposable. You've also got a sizable portion of the population, and it's growing all the time, where animals are more and more central to our lives. And some of this is a function of changing demographics, particularly millennials delaying marriage and, you know, getting pets as family members. So is there an obsession? I think perhaps some folks are obsessed, and I would happily count myself in that level. By the same token, pets, in my opinion, give more than they get in terms of what they can do for us. So, you know, definitely the human-animal bond is increasing dramatically, both in the U.S. and in other countries. But I think that's in part because people fully realize the value that pets bring to our lives, the joy, the stress reduction, the sense of purpose that they bring.
Yeah, and I agree. Go ahead, Don.
I was just going to break in on that. Just across my desk this morning came an article about how the older generation are taking to pets, particularly dogs, much more than in previous generations, because they are companions. And I love what you said, the line that they give much more than what they get. And on that note, I'd like to jump in with a question. I have a friend of mine who spent $15,000, I repeat, $15,000 to keep his dog alive. And I would have never – is that normal, Chris? And does the insurance cover things like that?
So is it normal? No, that's fairly unusual. To get technical for just a second here, in any given year, about 97% of our policyholders will not exceed $5,000 a year in care. Unfortunately, most of the time when you start to get above numbers like that, the pet has simply passed away. Does it happen? Yes. We see claims like that on not a completely infrequent basis, but just overshadowed by the smaller claims. And given the sophistication of veterinary medicine, which is starting to rival human health care, it's going to be happening more and more all the time. And, you know, for better or worse, I'm one of those folks that will I would spend that if I was confident that my pet would have a good outcome. I wouldn't subject my pet to anything, you know, where I thought they'd have a poor outcome, but I would spend that on my pets. And having insurance and knowing that I can do that without, you know, needing to take out a second mortgage is very, very comforting.
It was just amazing. I happen to know that he did not have insurance, and he paid it out of his pocket.
Yes.
But I was just amazed by it, and remained amazed by to this day. But as you say, we're starting. The veterinarian care is starting to approach human care. But is that good or bad? Well, what do you see are the long-term effects of this sort of trend?
Well, you know, it puts a tremendous strain on both pet owners and on veterinarians and their staff. And that strain is because, you know, formerly your pet had an issue and there was just nothing medically that could be done. And so to euthanize the pet was the appropriate and compassionate solution. With the increasing sophistication of veterinary medicine and the associated costs that go with it, you know, it's putting more and more people into difficult situations where they know that their pet could have a good outcome, but they simply don't have the economic wherewithal to support it. And they end up putting the pet down for economic reasons, which is within the industry referred to as economic euthanasia. And that's very, very stressful on both pet owners and obviously the medical staff that has to do that. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're seeing such tremendous growth in the pet health insurance industry is the awareness that these things can happen, that you do, in fact, view your pet as a member of your family, and that you can have a good medical outcome. And so that's why more and more folks, I think, are purchasing pet health insurance, is just to take the worry away that they'll have to put their pet down for something other than a compassionate medical reason.
Back to you, Dan.
I want to find out, what does it cost for different kinds of pet insurance? Can you give us some idea?
Yeah. So there are a couple of factors, and I won't go real deep into this, but there are a couple of factors that determine the cost of a comprehensive accident and illness plan. One is the pet age, and that's a very significant driver of what pet insurance premiums cost. The second is breed. Certainly, I think we're all aware of the fact that some breeds are far, far more expensive and are more prone to problems. And then the last major driver is where that pet lives. And it's much more expensive to seek veterinary care in Manhattan than it is in Boise, Idaho. So all of those things said, on average, for a new pet that's buying pet insurance at Pets Best, it costs about $35 to $40 a month for a comprehensive accident and illness plan. And as the pet ages, obviously prices do increase. And so I've got one year old that I'm paying about $25 a month for, and my older girl who's nine, who I had to take into the vet this morning, you know, she's I think $46 or $47 a month for me.
And the third one, you said you had three of them.
Yeah. No, I've got an obnoxious little guy who you may have heard growling a moment ago, running around at my desk. I pay $25 a month for him.
So you're paying almost $100 a month for your three pets. We're pretty close to that.
I am. Yes.
$1,200 a year.
Yeah.
And for some people, that's a lot of money.
Oh, without doubt, it's a sizable amount of money. Absolutely. You have to compare it with other areas that we spend our money on. A lot of folks who maintain that they can't afford pet insurance are hitting their local specialty coffee shop up every day and spending that much in coffee. And I've just chosen, and I'm not saying this is right or wrong, I've just chosen to prioritize them, because I'm well aware of what they mean to me, and I'm also well aware of the fact that if something does happen, I am going to pay the bill, and I would just assume pay that bill with help. And at a personal level, the guy I talked about cost $25 a month. He racked up $2,500 in expenses last Christmas, and so fortunately with insurance, the vast majority of that was covered, and I had the peace of mind of knowing that, and the peace of mind that I knew I could get the most appropriate care.
You mentioned that one of the criteria, you talked about where the pet lives and those kinds of things, and I'm curious, and then you mentioned breed. I don't know how to ask the question, but what's the most expensive breed to insure?
Off the top of my head, that's going to be a bit of a challenge, but Great Danes, Boxers, and Bernese Mountain Dogs crop up as being particularly expensive pets from a medical standpoint, just based on the fact that they're prone to a wide range of maladies. Great Danes in particular, are typically have a really limited lifespan, And that means that their medical problems, which are significant, get compressed into a really tight time frame. So those are some
good,
of the
I had
most
thought about
expensive.
That.
The least expensive dog? The least expensive dogs are almost uniformly your smaller breeds. They tend to have fewer maladies. They don't reach middle age until later in comparison to, for example, a Great Dane. And then the cost to treat them, just because, you know, they weigh 12 pounds, is less. So Chihuahuas are particularly inexpensive, it comes to mind.
Yeah, I was thinking about Beagles and Basset Hounds, and our last dog was a Bichon, and she lived almost 17 years, which everybody, the vets were saying that's just way off the charts, but she had good medical care.
Right, it matters.
Dan, I remember with cats, through a long story, I got my father a purebred Siamese, and which was one of the most intelligent animals I've ever seen in my life. But the question the vet said was, the purer the breed, the lesser the problems. Is that true?
The purer the breed, the lesser the problems?
I mean, if a crossbreed tends to have more problems than a purebred?
I'll tell you, that runs directly contradictory to the information we have. In fact, mixed breeds, with one exception, mixed breeds are the least expensive breed to insure. Well, they're not really a breed, but there's only one breed, and I believe that's Chihuahua, that is less expensive than a mixed breed. And we're making these determinations based upon, you know, 13 years in the industry and a tremendous amount of actuarial data. So, no, I can't support that in general.
No, we'll take you. We'll take you as the authority. This is many years ago, and I was curious. What's the one breed that was even less expensive?
Chihuahuas are a very inexpensive breed, depending upon, you know, which year it is and what data you have recently. But Chihuahuas and mixed breeds run neck and neck as the least expensive.
Okay. I was fascinated by just a snippet that you mentioned, and I would like you to expand upon it. And that was you talked about feral cat.
Yes.
What's the problem?
Well, so by no means am I an expert on the homeless pet situation. I just know, and it's more at an anecdotal level and some of my past experience, that feral cats are a very significant issue, and that there's a lot of programs in place to try to address the issue, to take them in and spay and neuter them. So I know it's an issue, and it tends to be an issue on a pretty widespread basis, but, you know, at that point I'm at the end of my knowledge about the feral cat issue in the U.S.
Okay. And as I recall, I was thinking there were more dogs than cats
there's more cats than dogs in the U.S. Somewhere in the neighborhood of, let's call it, 20 million more cats. Now, this contrasts with the fact that dogs are overwhelmingly more frequently insured than cats on about a 4-to-1 basis.
Can you ever get the cat to go to the doctor?
That is
stubborn.
Fact. You are absolutely correct. That's a real significant problem in the veterinary profession right now, is folks are less and less inclined to take their cat into the vet over time versus going back 10 or 15 years ago. So it's a real issue. People are not willing to take their cats to the vet as frequently as they need to go.
Because why do you think that is?
You know, there's been a tremendous amount of speculation about that. One, cats are much better at hiding signs of illness than dogs. And so frequently pet owners don't know that they've got an issue until it's really far down the road. The second one is cats hate to go to the vet. And it's a production to get your pet to the vet. And, you know, ironically, this may be where the fact that we're more empathetic with our pets now than we were, you know, a few years ago is actually coming back to bite us in terms of, you know, you empathize with your cat's utter hatred to going to the vet and you capitulate to that feeling and don't get your cat the care that it needs. So that's been one level of speculation is, you know,
Do you think it crosses over to humans? If you've got a cat that doesn't want to go to the doctor, do you, as a human, are you less likely to go to the doctor yourself?
No, that's an interesting speculation. I don't know. At a personal level, I don't like to go to the vet. All right, I don't like to go to the doctor, and I don't seek unnecessary care for my pets either. So, you know, that's a great question, but I haven't heard anything directly about the correlation.
Yeah, I don't know whether this is typical. I'll say it's typical, and then you can correct me if I'm wrong. Typical situation is a young family buys a cat or a dog and because the kids want it, and the kids can't take care of it and don't want to take care of it, and so mom or dad are left to taking care of it. And is the female or the male of the house more likely to be the pet care person in charge of pet care?
You know, that's a really interesting question. So for our own personal information that Pets Best and also what I know about the industry, women purchase about 70% of the pet health insurance for pets. So overwhelmingly, women buy pet insurance. Now, if you get into the millennial generation, which are now the largest cohort of pet owners, the men are much more likely to be the decision maker for that pet's health, which is, you know, a really interesting shift in terms of how things are going. But across the board, typically women, you start to get some generational differences when you drop into the millennials.
And so when you look at the ownership issue of and care, males versus females, I wonder in the overall scheme of things, because women still typically tend to outlive us as males, that the companionship offered by a pet is something that a woman would more likely gravitate to and therefore want to keep the pet.
You know, based on my personal observation, that's very sound. And certainly childless couples who have raised their children are very, very frequently the purchasers of pet health insurance. And so I can only support that at an anecdotal level.
So let me ask my last question, which is really, really important. Where do people go to buy pet insurance? And can you tell us where they can go get it?
How Absolutely. Get it? So it's very, very simple to buy a pet health insurance policy, particularly from Pets Best. The whole process can literally take about 4 minutes. So simply visit petsbest.com and you will see the ability to get a quote and then purchase online immediately. Interestingly, it's also a growing benefit within the employer group channel as the market gets more and more competitive. So, you know, before you make the determination to buy pet insurance, go and see if your employer has struck an arrangement so that you can get a discount. But it's very, very simple to get pet insurance, or you can simply call us. It's a very seamless, easy process. Petsbest.com.
Petsbest.com. Okay.
And literally the process, 4 or 5 minutes.
We're not finished, Dan, because I got a question for Chris Middleton, the president of Pets Best, which is a wild one because we just went to a tech show in which there were three companies there with tech products, one of which was an automated cleaner for the cat so that you didn't have to clean the cat litter for a full month, and the other one was a automatic fence device to keep your animal not only inside out, inside an outdoor area, but an inside area. My question to Chris is, are things like that improving the health of American pets, or is that or is the jury still out on that?
You know, I suspect that it's helping the lives of pets, but I don't have any direct information. I know that spending on pets tends to be recession-proof and has continued to grow, and more people are engaged with their pets and active with their pets than ever before. So I would say the general trend in terms of how folks are feeling about their pets is and how they're treating them is growing dramatically. When you look at the specialty foods and the growth of those markets, people obviously view taking care of their pets as very critical because they view them as family members.
You know, it's a really fascinating, you've brought a really fascinating aspect to the business. Well, I guess, but you brought up the fact that companies now offer it as a benefit. Is it large companies or smaller companies that are offering the benefit of pet insurance?
It's absolutely across the board. We see it across all levels of company, from Fortune 100 to companies with 50, 60 employees. And, particularly small companies are more likely to have pet-friendly policies. And if you've got a pet-friendly policy, you know, the ability to bring your pets into the workplace, obviously those folks are very keen about pets, realize their importance to their employees, importance of attracting good employees, and so they offer pet insurance very frequently as well. So the whole gamut in terms of size.
Well, we've been talking with Chris Middleton, the president of Pets Best. Chris, thank you so much.
Gentlemen, I appreciate the time, and anytime I can help put focus on pets and an important industry with pet health insurance, I'm really, really pleased to do it. So thanks for the time. Much appreciated.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
According to a new study, more businesses are reporting higher profits and a greater hiring process. Here to talk about what it means is Dr. Greg Everett, director of the Private Capital Markets Project for Pepperdine University's Graziadio School of Business and Management. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Dr. Everett, will you tell us a little bit about yourself, your Pepperdine School of Business, and the study?
Okay. Well, my name is Dr. Craig Everett. I'm a finance professor here at the business school at Pepperdine University, located in Malibu, California. So it's generally sunny and beautiful here. The Private Capital Markets Project was something that we published our first report back in 2012. What we're going to be talking about today is our Private Capital Access Report that we do in conjunction with Dun & Bradstreet. And we do this quarterly and to get a pulse on what the demand for capital is out there among private businesses, and what their access to capital is like.
This is Dan Perkins. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dan.
I want to follow up with what you just said. It seems to me, I'm a registered investment advisor. I've been managing money for about 43 years in private practice. And as I look at the market, there seems to me to be a ton of money looking for homes. And I don't mean houses, looking for a place to invest. The spreads of the margin in private equity and those types of transactions have come down. I remember when it was 2 and 20 and 5 and 20, and now it's much less than that. So is the glut of money having an adverse effect on the pricing of capital for risk takers?
Well, you're exactly right. There is a lot of money out there. And what we see in our research is that money is going to the middle market and not going to the small end. So lending and generally lending and equity investment for the smaller companies is still very tight. And it has improved a little bit over the past several years, but still. When I talk about small businesses, we're talking about less than $5 million in revenue, and then our lower middle market is $5 million to $100 million in revenue. $5 million to $100 million, the lower middle market, they have all the money they need, pretty much. They have really great access to capital, and don't seem to have any problems getting what they need. Now, the under $5 million revenue have always had a lot of problems with that, and they still do.
So what we've been talking over the last 6 or 8 months, we've had several guests on that are in the fintech business, that are non-banks that are loaning money. And we know that the major banks walked away from the small business market at the end of the last recession, but now are somewhat looking with interest because of the rebirth of the economy. But things have changed, and the fintech lenders are capturing more and more market space. They seem to want to deal with the small end, the small businessman, as opposed to middle market. Are you seeing a lot of fintech lenders starting up?
Yeah, there are a lot, because you're right. The banks have gotten out of that business a little bit. Now, there still are a lot of SBA loans going on, and those are done by, and those of course are done by banks. But of course, their risk profile is much lower because it's guaranteed by the government. But yeah, there are a lot of finance companies, non-bank finance companies that are in the market, particularly doing a lot of asset-based lending.
So that the small businessman is putting up either personal collateral, or if his business has hard assets, they've got to pledge all that as collateral for their loans.
Right, so it's accounts receivable, inventory, purchase orders, can be equipment, but there's some assets securing the loan.
Do you find that almost a dichotomy in this respect, that the small business, meaning businesses under 500 employees, create something like 80% of all the jobs in the country? They spur the country, yet they're the hardest people to get money to grow their businesses.
Yeah, but it's not quite that simple, because the standard default criterion from the Small Business Administration for the SBA loans, what defines a small business for them is typically, for most industries, is 500 employees or less, and that represents the vast majority of companies in the country. Almost every company is a small business by that definition, and there's really just a handful that are above 500 employees. I don't want to say a handful, but I mean, the, more than 90% of companies are small businesses by that definition. So what
right.
what I and a 500 employee company is not like in the like 5 million or less in revenue that we're defining small business as. So it, depending on who you talk to, that what we mean by small business really varies quite widely. But to answer your question, the actual small, the companies with 100 to 500 employees, they don't have any problem getting capital, it's really the smaller end of that has the problem.
So let's try and quantify that. Below what numbers of employees? 20, 10?
Yeah, I mean, I can't put my finger on that because what we do in our study is we measure the size of a company by its revenue, not the number of employees. So I don't have an exact answer to that. But yeah, with 5 million in revenue, you're usually talking, you're talking, 20 employees or less probably.
Dan, can I jump in on a question? I have two, actually. I've been in the small business space for over 20 years and reporting on it. And my definition of a small business is when a person says it's our business and when rather than the business. But I guess my first question, do you think capital is more readily today than in past years? And is the cost of capital going up or down?
It depends on what kind of capital. So the answer to your first question is, so access to capital really peaked before the financial crisis in 2008, 2009. Money was freely available. Then access to capital completely dried up and slowly has been coming back. So in general, it's been improving since 2009 steadily. But it's kind of leveled off at this point. But we do see, it's been pretty stable over the past year or two. Now to the other question, the cost of capital, that depends on what kind of capital. So if we're talking about loans, then we are seeing the rates creeping up. So that capital is getting more expensive. The cost of equity capital, like say for the expected returns of private equity investors, venture capital investors, that has been going down. So it depends on what kind of capital you're talking about.
Well, that's very interesting that you say the venture capitalists are expecting less. Am I hearing you correctly?
Yeah. So basically, particularly private equity. I mean, so 15 years ago, private equity expected returns were like in the 30s, and venture capital expected returns were in the 40s. But now they're both in the low 20s.
Wow. Back to you, Dan. I gotta digest that one.
Yeah, no, I'm very, very familiar with that. And part of at least my perspective on why the expected returns are down is a function, and you may agree or disagree, is the function of the lack of performance anywhere near those expectations over the last 8 years.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that, and also add one additional point is that it's also a function of the amount of money that's on the sidelines right now looking for a home, as you stated before. So the type of companies that are getting funded aren't the cream of the crop anymore. They're having to push down into the next tier of higher risk, maybe not quite so promising companies because they have to place that money somewhere, and so that hurts returns as well. Also, as they overpay because they're competing with each other for some of these deals, if they overpay for these deals and the valuations are too high, that also hurts returns.
Yeah, I saw a report within the last month that some of the private equity funds so far this year are actually underperforming the S&P 500.
Yeah, which is crazy that you can your returns for a fully diversified portfolio of public company stocks, which is an extremely low risk profile, would be the same performance as an extremely high risk private equity portfolio.
Or beat the private equity, and I think that what you pointed out, which was important, is that because there's so much money, they've had to go down. Many of the private equity or venture capital have had to go down in a lower tier of credit and risk to try and find places to put money to work.
And the other thing that you see happening, which you never saw happening in private equity previously, is they're taking minority stakes in companies, and which is really quite a new phenomenon. Traditionally, private equity has always insisted on a majority stake because they want to be able to make changes in the company and not have any resistance.
Right.
But it's gotten so competitive that their private equity firms are actually taking minority stakes, and that's very common now.
Is that because a minority stake will cost them less money?
I think it's more a function of competition. Is that there's multiple firms going after these best deals, and so the companies receiving the private equity funding can negotiate a better deal where they don't have to give away a majority of their company anymore.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that is here to stay, or is that going to change?
I would think that would eventually change. Once money gets tighter, at some point it will, and there's not as much competition. It's not as much of a seller's market for these firms, and so the valuations are lower. I think it'll go back to majority stake. I mean, obviously that's what a private equity firm wants, the majority stake, because they want to be able to go in there and change the management. They want to be able to change the operations in order to increase the valuation and resell the company. And it's just much more difficult to do anything proactive if you're a minority shareholder.
Yeah. The president announced his candidate for chairman of the Federal Reserve, and the early read on him is that, this is Powell, that he's pretty much a continuation of Chairman Yellen's policy. Do you have any insight on that?
And that's my understanding as well. I don't know him, but that's kind of my read on it as well. He might be a little bit more business friendly and regulation wise, but you know, the time will tell.
When the Fed's talking about the possibility of three more rate hikes, one in December and two, possibly three in 18. So that would take us up, theoretically, 75 basis points from where we are, which would put the yield on the 10-year Treasury probably around 3%. Still not an outrageous return, a little bit better than the S&P 500 dividend yield, but not a significant yield structure. So is it possible that the new chairman of the Fed It may back off, since we don't have inflation and we don't have terribly high employment numbers?
Yeah, I think that's a difficult difficult tightrope to walk, and you know, we'll see. That seems like a lot, considering how long that we've been in this low interest rate environment. I am a fan of bringing rates back up, but I'm not sure if I would do it quite that quickly. I think that could be that could have a chilling effect.
What do you think of the challenges our economy is facing today?
Well, I mean, from our research anyway, the big challenge of the economy right now, that we're seeing optimism from businesses. The businesses are the number that are expecting revenue growth this year is up, and so that's good news. But what's interesting is that their expectations for going after external capital for growth is down. So what that's telling me is that that the companies are kind of getting into a play it safe kind of mode where, yeah, they're expecting to grow, but they're going to do it organically. They're not going to seek outside capital or loans or whatever to expand their business, but just kind of wait and see. So yeah, I think from our standpoint, what we're seeing is expectation of growth, but just modest organic growth. People aren't going out and borrowing money to grow their companies right now.
So you're thinking that the momentum has shifted to being more conservative because of the uncertainty of the tax bill or Obamacare or just the general growth in the economy? Or is it all of that?
I think it's all that.
In your study, you also seem to indicate you think hiring is going to go up and it will continue to grow?
Yeah, hiring people seem to be planning to hire. The thing from our study that's interesting, and this is good news, is that over last year the composition of the hiring has slightly changed, where there's a little bit more of a shift toward hiring full-time employees rather than part-time. So that's a new thing, and that's a good thing.
Well, do you think the competition? There's still a lot of unemployable types of individuals out there. But do you think that companies will consider training these people or investing the time to train them? Or do you think they will still remain outside the workforce?
That's a difficult question to answer. That's not part of our research, but just my own sense of that is from what I'm seeing locally is that there's that companies in general have been tightening quite a bit over the last certainly 10 years, but even more recently. And so things like tuition reimbursement and training and such have suffered. So I'm not sure. I'm not seeing yet a big push or a big excitement within companies about spending a lot of money on training and such. It seems like that has dwindled over the past years.
You know, I have to say, listening, that this is one of the most illuminating conversations on the economy we've had in a long time. So pardon me for delving a little further, Doctor, because it just it seems that you have a good handle on it. What I meant by also training is taking somebody and saying, well, he or she doesn't have all the skills, but we can mold him or her into a job. Do you think for the last 8 years that has not been the case? Do you think that will happen now simply because of the shrinking labor pool?
Yeah, it could. Again, I don't have any specific insights into that, but it seems like, particularly for highly skilled jobs, it's a lot of those are going unfilled. So at some point, if the company wants to grow, they're gonna have to grow their workforce, and they're gonna have to get people with those skills somewhere. So it's either retrain local people or bring in skilled workers from abroad on visas, or they have to do something to bring people up to speed, and so otherwise they can't grow.
But the nice thing about your message is you're saying the companies are growing. That's what I'm hearing from this conversation. Am I wrong on that point?
No, you're right. They're growing. It's modest. But they're growing, and they have expectations over the next 6 months to grow more.
Well, that's really good news. Dan, back to you.
Yes, Doctor. I wanted to go back to the question I was wanted to ask just before Don asked his important questions, and that is, what do you think is the importance for the continuation of growth in this economy for a tax bill?
Well, it seems like, I mean, some of that has already been baked in, I think. I think a lot of the confidence that's out there is based on the fact that there's an expectation that that's going to happen. So if it does happen, of course, that should be a boost, but I'm not sure if it's going to be too dramatic because people have been expecting it for a while and you know, losing patience a little bit because I think there was an expectation that this tax bill would have happened a long time ago.
So if we don't get a tax bill, it could be negative for the market, at least short term.
Oh, absolutely.
Doctor, I was, if I can take you back in time, to September 2008, I think around the 14th or the 15th of September, when Congress failed to pass a bill and the stock market dropped 1,000 points. And we all thought maybe it was going to be the end of the world, or some people did. The financial world, and we've come all the way back to record highs on the Dow and the S&P 500. We have not had a substantial correction in the equity market literally since before Trump took office. What does your crystal ball tell you about the near-term direction of the market?
Well, I agree with pretty much everybody out there is that it's not a matter of when the bubble will pop, or it's not a matter of if, but when. And so at some point there has to be a correction. And there pretty much are no cheap stocks out there anymore. And so, you know, one thing that's been fueling this is the low interest rate environment is incentivizing companies to take out debt in order to repurchase stock. So you've got companies out there that are you know, their earnings per share look great because there are less shares, and so it's but at some point the party has to end.
Yeah, but when a company starts to buy back its stock, it's saying, at least my understanding is, that there's no better place to put the money. And so there's no real other opportunity, so that they think that the management and the board thinks that the best opportunity is buying their own company stock, because that's where they're going to get the best return. So that companies buying their stock is a positive thing, because it reduces the amount of outstanding and doesn't dilute the shares, earnings per share, and creates an opportunity because of a scarcity factor. I remember reading, Doctor, not too long ago, how many shares, what percentage of the market has been taken off the market by company buybacks and mergers and acquisition. And it's a very substantial percentage of the market. So I just think that companies and the board of directors have a prudent responsibility. If the best thing to do with the corporate cash is to buy the stock back, it's better for the remaining shareholders, and I think it's a positive thing. If in turn they think that they're going to start buying things, then the board is saying, we think there is a better opportunity to go out and buy XYZ company because it'll produce better returns than what we have in our own company today.
I mean, yeah, obviously, what a shareholder should really want the company to do is to use their retained earnings and such to actually expand the business. I mean, that's the best news. If you have cash sitting there and you have nothing to spend it on, either through an acquisition or just expanding organically your business, then that's a bad thing. If the best thing that you have to do with your money is repurchase shares, that means that that you've kind of punted on your growth opportunities for the company and don't really think that you have significant growth opportunities. And so, share repurchases, I mean, yeah, they mechanically make some of the ratios look a lot better. They mechanically help return on equity. They mechanically help earnings per share. That doesn't really help actual earnings, the actual dollar amount of the earnings, but the earnings per share goes up. And so it's So I mean, certainly shareholders, would like that effect of it, but it's too bad that they can't find actually something productive to do with their money instead.
This has been a fascinating interview with Dr. Greg Everett from Pepperdine University Graduate School, but we've got to unfortunately move on. How can Dr. Everett? How can we people access the study and everything else, and yourself?
Best thing to do is just Google Private Capital Markets Project. That'll take you to the Pepperdine website, which is bschool.pepperdine.edu. But you can pretty easily find all of our reports, all of our research is all downloadable for free from our website. That's just look for Private Capital Markets Report or Private Capital Markets Project, and they'll take you right to me.
Oh, really, thank you for a very illuminating time. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz.